thanks again for making the time. I know it's a busy time as we're getting into Christmas and the holidays and like
December. No problem.
Gonzo time.
Yeah, it's nuts.
I guess, yeah, I mean, Christmas is all toys too, right? So this is kind
of... Yeah. Right? It's relevant.
Yeah. Everybody wanted to get the, like, the Toys R Us catalog back in the day, right? And kind of like circle all like the He-Man and G.I. Joe things they wanted. Yo, welcome to my summer layer. I'm your host, Sammy. More he than man, Yunnan. I am a fan of Philly-based cartoonist Brian Box Brown's work and have read most of it. He follows his passions, which mirrors many of my passions. Often the things he likes and grew up with resonated in my heart. Tetris, Andy Kaufman, and wrestling. Okay, about the wrestling. I'm an NBA guy, not a wrestling fan, but his Andre the Giant biography is fantastic. Shout out to Princess Bride, yo. With the He-Man effect, how American toy makers sold your childhood. Oh. He reveals how our childish attention has been bought and sold by mass media, entertainment, and sadly, most especially, the toy industry. On page 197 of the He-Man effect, he writes, He-Man, G.I. Joe, and Transformers represented the first wave of characters in this new, unregulated toy media landscape. Deregulation ripped the market wide open. Hasbro and Mattel had gotten the jump on the competition, but the cat was out of the bag now. The market became robust and competitive. It was a feeding frenzy for children's imagination. Yo, there's a fascinating tension because the things we grew up with, the toys we enjoyed, were always meant to turn us into permanent consumers. Like, right now, the Barbie movie was a massive hit. Nostalgia instantly overcame decades of legitimate Barbie criticism about women's bodies, roles in the workplace, setting example for other young girls, all the things Barbie the doll has been slagged for years. Instantly gone, dismissed. And the Barbie movie was a massive box office hit. The 80s marketing was so effective, it basically made us corporate prisoners with a life sentence. The Barbie movie. Kevin Smith is working on He-Man cartoons for Netflix. There's many more recent examples. None of these characters and none of these universes have ever gone away because of the full-scale marketing work done in the 80s. That's how potent the 80s were. How do we balance nostalgia with capitalism? Star Wars is so fun. The lightsabers and Darth Vader and Death Stars. But Star Wars is also a billion-dollar business of t-shirts and video games and action figures and comic books and novels and so much more. All of this is what Brian is exploring in The He-Man Effect. It's a nonfiction book, a well-researched historical graphic novel published by First Second. First Second is a fantastic publisher. Shout out to First Second. And Brian's graphic novel, The He-Man Effect, it's loaded with many Simpsons Easter eggs. Yes, those made me laugh. Because again, I'm still watching The Simpsons. That too hasn't gone away. And Brian will return to The Simpsons as his kids get older and he introduces it to them. This isn't this isn't bad in a black or white sort of thing. It's just being aware of how we got here. If you've watched The Toys That Made Us on Netflix, this is the part of the joyful story that they told that they left out. Here's my conversation with Brian about his fantastic graphic novel, The He-Man Effect.
Sound, the final frontier. My summer lair is an enterprise, a pop culture voyage with a continuing mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new creators and celebrate established producers, to boldly go where no podcast has gone before. And now here is your host, Sammy Yunnan.
Brian, just to provide some context, can you tell me some of your favorite cartoons or even characters? What did you like when you were a little kid growing up? What did you gravitate towards?
Oh, so I was just thinking about this recently because I was in Brazil at a comic convention and there was this cartoon called the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon.
Say
came out in 1983. It was a Dungeons and Dragons cartoon.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it was so that came out in like 1983. That was like something I really liked. I've been kind of revisiting that. That was really big in Brazil. So when I was in Brazil, there was like a bunch of people dressed as those characters, which was cool.
That one made it all the way out to Brazil?
It was huge in Brazil, bigger than the US. Like, wow. Like it was just like this huge, huge thing. You know, when I was a kid, I loved He-Man and Transformers and G.I. Joe. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I loved, you know, the toys for Mask and, you know, a million other things, you know.
Mask should be due for a reboot or revival.
A reboot soon.
Yeah, right? Like, it's been time. Like, yeah. Like that and Silverhawks. There's a few of them like that that have kind of fallen off. Right? Thundercats is still hanging around. Like, He-Man, obviously, is Kevin Smith.
I'm surprised they never went back and got Thunderhawks, or Silverhawks, mm-hmm. rather. I mean, it was just like Thundercats.
Yeah.
And it was so similar. There's just so many, and, you know, and Mask was like a proven toy. It was cool. It was like a Transformer, basically. Mm-hmm. But it had figures and stuff. That was a cool toy. I loved Muscle.
Oh, yeah. Was
one of my faves, too. And Battle Beasts, I really liked that, too.
Mm-hmm. Mask was a good, like, kind of combination between, like, G.I. Joe and Transformers.
Yeah, because you got a guy with it. He has his little helmet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was cool. Cool bunch of little toys.
So your book, your graphic novel is called The He-Man Effect. And history is weird when you write about your own history, like the things that you experienced. Like, this isn't you writing a graphic novel about, like, Abraham Lincoln, right? For example, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, you know what He-Man is in Mask, and I clearly do as well. Like, what was the story you wanted to tell knowing that you personally had these experiences or you went through these rituals?
You know, so... I guess I kind of, at first, I was just kind of exploring, you know, a little bit of like reason, you know, why, because, actually even before that, I was just started getting interested in vintage toys without even, you know, just because I was at these comic conventions and stuff, you know, I'd go to these big comic shows and I'd be walking around and, there was always like a contingent of vintage toys salespeople there.
Mm-hmm.
So they would, you know, I'd find myself there. I'd be like buying Muscle and buying Battle Beast, buying G.I. Joes and stuff like that. And I went to a vintage toy convention that was like near my home. And I was just struck by how many people were there and how big it was and how many people were still profiting off of these old properties. Like, there's still like people making, you know, their whole life, their whole yearly salary is being mm-hmm. the buying and selling of these old toys and stuff still, you know. And I was just like, damn, that is some like intensely powerful advertising. That must have been so that's quite a marketing campaign. And then, you know, it was like from that point, I think, was when I started to think about it in kind of a different way. Like, well, you know, that was quite an advertising campaign to for the first time ever, target kids directly and show them ads for 24 hours straight. I mean, you know, every single cartoon show on television is an advertisement for a toy. You know, they all have commercials also. So, like, all children's programming is 100% advertising. Yeah, that's quite a... that's quite an advertising campaign.
Do you like now being an adult and having the spending power to get the ones that you want, like to get a Transformers action figures, for example? You know what I mean? Because I'm sure that as a kid, there was ones that got away or you weren't able to get them.
There are.
You
know what I mean? So it's funny.
So you get your revenge now?
I still, you know, I look through everything every once in a while on eBay and start looking through all the different toys and I almost buy a lot of things. Like I have a lot of things sitting in my cart, you know.
Okay.
But I always think that, like, I will do that one day when I have, when I'm like rich or something. I'll go back and get all the things in mint condition and and mint in the box and then open it up.
Yeah,
I would open it right up.
And you're gonna have like a big like G.I. Joe Transformers Mask He-Man War and just like spread them all over your bed. And,
Yeah, I mean, you know, open it up, open and close the hatch a bunch of times, mm-hmm. Put the guy in there. You know, I don't know. I don't even remember how I played with them when I was a kid. I mean, my dad told me one time when I was like really little, I was like, Dad, come play He-Man with me. And he comes over and he's like, okay, let's play. And he takes the He-Man and the Skeletor and he's like, oh, Skeletor, I am going to get you, blah, blah, blah. He starts doing that. And I'm like, Dad, that's not how you play. This is how you play. Bang, 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 bang. And just like slam them against each other.
Yeah. It's funny because like I tweeted you that Cabbage Patch documentary that just came out, Billion Dollar Babies. And the Cabbage Patch kids were huge, but I never understood how you play with them. Like, the at least, like,
yeah.
G.I. Joe, Cobra, like, there's at least a little tension there, right? Like, Autobots,
yeah, you know,
Decepticons, like, what do you do with... If you just have one Cabbage Patch kid, what do you do with it?
Yeah. It is fascinating that was, like, a doll. I mean, kids have been interested in dolls forever, but, you know, it was a doll that took off for boys and girls. It was like everybody was buying these Cabbage Patch Kid dolls. Well, I remember actually Cabbage Patch Kid action figures. So I don't know if you remember this. They came out with little action, you know, little Cabbage Patch Kids that were like this big. Mm-hmm. And I remember like thinking those were so cool and being like, you know, but you know, I don't really remember the Cabbage Patch craze as it happened because I was like 2 or 3 years old, I think.
Your graphic novel He-Man, like, it reminds me of this line from Ghostbusters. Gozer says, choose the form of your destroyer, right? And then they're like, yeah. Bill Murray's like, nobody think of anything. Nobody think of anything, right? And yeah. Then Gozer goes, the form has been chosen. And then Ray basically, Dan Aykroyd, Ray says, I tried to think of the most harmless thing, something I loved from my childhood, something that could never ever destroy us, right? And it was Mr. Stay Puff, and of course he comes in and starts mashing up.
And starts destroying them, that's true.
Yeah, that's kind of like also, I guess, part of the themes of your graphic novel. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it's no, like... that is. I mean, you know, I talk in the book about... Citizen Kane, right? And he has his rosebud, and it's like this thing that weighs heavily on you and like affects you in kind of like a profound way, and it's something so simple and you know, stupid, like your sled, your Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, you know, your He-Man toy, whatever it is, you know, that a lot of the times I draw when I'm signing people's books, I'll just draw the arm from He-Man. Mm-hmm. Now, like, I don't know if you remember the toys, like their arms would come off.
Yep.
So like my He-Man's always were missing arms, or they'd have like two different arms and stuff like that. And so for some reason, that to me, that what sticks out to He-Man is just like the disembodied arm that has like that hole in it where, you know, like the shoulder goes to. So I always draw that. Like just the arm that came off. A reader one time wrote to me or was telling me that that stood out to him because it was something also that he just has this memory of the arm, and his dad like helped him put like a piece of paper towel in it so it wouldn't fall off anymore or something like that. It was like this deep memory of just like a piece of a toy, which is, you know, it's like this, I always say, like, you can't choose the things you're nostalgic for. They just started there, right? You know, that's why you have things like guilty pleasures and things like that. And so, you know, I'm nostalgic for the He-Man arm. I want a He-Man's arm. So, like, it's just silly. It's like a worthless piece of plastic, yet it means everything.
Is there He-Man arms being sold on eBay? Just a random arm you
can buy
for like $1 or something?
I'm sure there are because they fall off all the time. So if people are looking for a complete figure, you know.
It's funny, like, doing this research, right? There's a lot of notes, and you obviously did a lot of research, and it covers the social impact that marketing to children has had, or is having, I guess, right? Because, like... Barbie movie just came out. Like,
it's not ending.
Yeah, right. Like He-Man is Kevin Smith is just coming back on Netflix. Like, so it did have and is having, like, so did any of that research color your perspectives on your own childhood? Did you feel like, I don't know, maybe tainted or manipulated a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, like, I can't. I don't really look back on it in a. Yeah. The book, in a way, is kind of a response to the Netflix movie, "The Toys That Made Us," and not necessarily like I don't. There's nothing in it that's like disputed or anything like that. It's more about like the attitude they take towards it, where it's like this this beautiful, like wonderful thing, and you know there was nothing, you know, ill-gotten about it. It's just this wonderful, oh, we love our childhood so much. And it's like, yeah, I get it. Being nostalgic about your childhood is like a part of life. But at the same time, like, it's important to recognize how that feeling of nostalgia is being manipulated by companies constantly. And it's so a powerful motivator in advertising and marketing.
Yeah, the way you write about some of the companies, like you're a big wrestling fan, and it kind of reminded me a little bit of like their heels, right?
Yeah.
Where there's a little bit of love there, right? Because obviously they gave you He-Man and they gave you Mask.
Sure.
And like, but at the same time, there's also like, I guess, a defiant hate or clear contempt. I don't know what word you would use. You know what I mean? But it's like,
yeah,
it's the same kind of feelings you would have with Iron Sheik, I guess, for lack of a better.
I mean, I just think, you know, there was something going on. There was something in the water in that period of time where, you know, this was seen as like a singular good to sell as many toys as possible and build up the economy or whatever and build up the industry and whatnot was seen as like a good. The naysayers were seen as just like, you know, complete like assholes, like just like impeding process, you know, progress and all that stuff. And so to look back on it now and see, you know, what the outcomes have been from that, you know, acting that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's tough to then look back on it and be like, oh, this is so great, so wonderful. As much as I love He-Man, it's so silly. Like, it's so clearly, like, every episode is, like, introducing a new toy. It's just so silly and funny now. I mean, like, to think of it as, like, a, you know, a beloved art form or, like, piece of media. It's, like, all a commercial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, 100 episodes of a commercial. For a toy set.
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the popular narratives that we're currently engaged in, and we talk about this all the time, is that we talk about the guys who are running Apple or Amazon or a lot of these tech companies, and we keep calling them a genius. They're geniuses, right? And that's not necessarily always true. Like, some of them are just kind of locked out or whatever it may be. And I like that in your book, He-Man Effect, like, some of the toy executives didn't seem geniuses at all. They were just kind of randomly making it up as they went along. Like Bernard Loomis, for example, he was an executive, and he was like, "Let's make the Star Wars figures this big," and he held out his fingers, which was about 3 or 4 inches, right?
Yeah, he just was like, "This is the idea." That's what I kind of like.
There's no market research. There's no like.
This is kind of like my what I love about pro wrestling too, and when they talk about stuff behind the scenes in pro wrestling, because, you know, you see it, what you see is what you know, becomes like canon and like, oh, you know, Brutus Beefcake was injured before this. He didn't wrestle, blah, blah, blah. You know, and then you hear the real story behind it and it's so funny and silly and like, oh, that wasn't a like story wise decision. It's just because like this guy got arrested the night before, like, on the show. It's just, like, very, very funny, like, how happenstance just, like, ends up certain ways. Yeah, that guy's just, like, picking it out, but holding his finger up, being like, yeah, they should be about yay big. That ended up becoming, like, the standard toy size for figures for, like, a super long time. Mm-hmm. It still is, to a certain extent, you know, because it was the size of G.I. It was the size of Star Wars, then it was the size of G.I. Joe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then others that followed it,
and it makes sense because you could put them in the vehicles and stuff like that. So
yeah,
I get it, but it was just funny that like there's no like focus group or market research or like, you know what I mean?
Like, it's just this is the size of a child's hand, like, or something like that.
But at the same time, as they're like making this up as they go along, they're also making like blunders. I like the fact that your book acknowledges like the death of Optimus Prime, right? Which was like stunning. I saw that at the cinema, and when he died, it was like complete silence. And then a couple of kids started to kind of like cry a little bit, right? Like, you know, and then when the credits roll, there was no dream, there was no time machine. They didn't.
It was like he didn't come back to life at the end.
And you're like, wait a second. Like, and there was no Marvel. Like, this is not a Marvel movie where, you know, there's like maybe a little scene at the end after credits or whatever.
No.
Like, so.
He's rolled. Dead, man.
Yeah, and the whole, all the kids just sat there until the final thing for the credits rolled, and then we're like, what happened? We don't understand. It took a while for that to emotionally be absorbed.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of a crazy idea to kill off the main character in the movie, just to bring back, not even bring him. I mean, I don't think they intended to bring him right back, because that's what they did, but you know, they wanted to make more new toys, so that's what they ended up doing.
That's what you're saying with wrestling, where like you find out the story behind the story. But at the time, you're not thinking about new toys. You're not thinking about anything. You're just like,
Optimus. Yeah, you just watched a movie. You're not. It's just this whole playing with kids' imaginations is dangerous. These guys were playing on like dangerous ground, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know if dangerous is the proper word, but it's a very specific time in a child's life that has very far reaching impact on the rest of their life. And so fucking around in that spot, you know, maybe we shouldn't fuck around all that much there.
Yeah. You have a great line. You write, nostalgia's power comes from its connection to our identities. Nostalgia's power comes from its connection to our identities. Can you unpack that a little bit? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so like when we think about the experience of nostalgia is a memory of your childhood usually, but not always. Like sometimes it's just of another time in your life. But when you're, it's a core memory, right? It's something that you've been building for many years. And it becomes part of your personal narrative, these like core memories. And when we talk about nostalgia, like that's what we're talking about. Like it's like these emotional memories. And so that's like what your personality gets built upon is all this stuff. You know, it's you're when you're developing who you are, you're developing a narrative about telling yourself about who you are. You know, all these things play a huge role in building up into, you know, the person that you become. And so when your nostalgia things kind of get fucked up, it can kind of fuck you up because it's like part of your identity. That's why you see stuff like people not reacting in extreme ways about like the casting of Star Wars and things like that.
Ghostbusters.
Yeah, Ghostbusters too, another one. Where it's like it doesn't fit into my memory of how things were. Mm-hmm. You know, Ghostbusters is a good example because it ended up becoming such a big hit for kids after the movie came out. I don't know if they would have made a Ghostbusters 2 if the Ghostbusters cartoon show wasn't a huge, huge smash success hit.
Yeah.
Where it was like the biggest toy of 1987 and, you know, stretched on into the next bunch of years after that. And you look at like what happened when they rebooted Ghostbusters, you know, I don't know if that all that toy advertising may have played a role in that as well.
That's an interesting connection. Yeah. Cause it's a strange thing. Like I wear Jordans, right, as the shoes, and so that's part of my identity. And if you ask people, whatever, yeah, Sammy wears Jordans. But it's also a weird thing because it's a mass marketed product, so it's not like I'm distinct or original or unique.
Right. There's like a million other people also wearing Jordans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so You talked about the kids in Brazil who were representing Dungeons & Dragons. Like, they've made that part of their identity. Obviously, they've been like...
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, I don't know how old they are, but like, that show's been around since the 80s, right? So they've been chilling with it. They probably read anything that they could read or interviews with the voice actors. You know what I mean? All that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
It's part of their identity. But it's a show that we all watched. So it's kind of weird, right? Like how you develop an identity off a mass market product.
You know, it's something that doesn't happen, I don't think, as much nowadays because things are so varied and interests are so... There's so many different things now. There was less... For example, like if you look at just like He-Man and G.I. Joe, it was like there was two or three cartoon shows that really dominated that we all watched it. Like it was like across the United States and the world. That mm-hmm. He-Man was a huge worldwide hit.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like this mass experience. And I think that stuff like that that creates these, creates generations and creates like a generational likeness or generational personality is these shared experiences. But you know, things have changed a lot since back then, where now people are, you have a shared experience, but it's not necessarily with the people near you or around you. Because you know, you can get into things that are so varied and, you know, maybe it's you and people from all over the world are interested in it, but not necessarily the kid next door.
Yeah, Stranger Things is an example of what you're talking about. Like, it is popular, but like, same thing when I go to comic book conventions, you don't see a lot of like 11s or like, you know what I mean? Like, you still see a lot of the classic, like Batmans and Supermans and things like that.
Sure.
Ghostface Killer from Scream. I've seen a few of those on the last convention I went to. But you generally don't see a lot of like Stranger Things kind of cosplay or like even t-shirts and things like that, even though it has obviously a market.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, it's longevity. Maybe in 20 years, we'll see people that were kids when Stranger Things came out that are adults that are get back into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's like paying dividends when you are working on a property that a children's property. It's something that can pay dividends down the road when those same children become adults. Like when you look at like the way they marketed the Barbie movie this year towards a generation of adults that play with Barbie as kids, not necessarily to you know, the kids who play with Barbie.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of marketed towards their parents, but kind of both. But Barbie like was an insane phenomenon. But really, it's a toy commercial, ultimately. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a worldwide cultural phenomenon, but ultimately a commercial for toys.
It was funny because, like, Barbie's a good example because, like, a lot of our pop culture is still dominated by the IP that we helped create and we invested in the 80s, like Aliens, like RoboCop, Rambo, He-Man, like Barbie's still floating around, My Little Pony's still floating around, Star Wars is still huge. Like, we put time and money into all of this stuff.
Right? I mean, they put time and money into us.
Yeah.
And we're giving it back to them as adults. I mean, I think that's what happens. I mean, with Disney, right, like, they've figured out a way to have somebody interested in their product, like, from birth to death.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, ultimately, that's what, you know, media and these, you know, companies want. They want lifetime brand loyalty.
Yeah, but it also traps us in this reboot cycle, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, right now on TV, like, Magnum P.I. is on, Equalizer is on, Night Court is on, Quantum Leap is on. Like, I don't know if you have kids, but if you do, like, they're having the exact same childhood you did.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how that is true, how they reboot everything. It is as it always has been, though. All right, so think about it this way. What was Disney's first big movie? Snow White.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't write Snow White. Snow White was like a fairy tale that was a reboot, basically. So, like, even their first big films, Snow White, Pinocchio, these were Disney-fied reboots of old material.
Just took out all the blood and guts.
Yeah, I mean, Walt Disney, like, the guy, played Peter Pan in his high school play. So, I mean, like, all of this, a lot of the stuff that they were doing was reboots right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. It started with reboots.
So then, is corrupted the right word? Like, are imaginations corrupted?
Because I don't know.
The way that all this, like, long-term marketing, like you said, almost like propaganda, right?
I don't know if we're necessarily corrupted, but I think we're all affected by not just toy advertising, but all kinds of advertising. Mm-hmm. I just think that the specific toy advertising to children is so powerful. And that period of time when they decided, when they deregulated, was just so crazy. It just created such a crazy, crazy feeding frenzy.
That period of deregulation, you're talking about Reagan as well.
Like, yeah.
His phrase way before Trump was "Make America Great Again."
Yeah.
And that obviously was a slogan that was rooted in nostalgia. And for yeah. you, how do you balance nostalgia without falling into the trap that, like, the past was better? Or seeing it through like the rose-colored glasses, right? Like, you talked about the Star Wars groups and the Ghostbusters groups were upset because the past was better.
Right. I mean, you just have to remind yourself always that it's just not the case. I mean, like,
the He-Man arm falls back, off.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's just, I think about it like this. So I would go back, I would give anything to, like, go back in time and, like, go to my grandma's house on, like, a summer day when I was off from school. Like, I would love to do that now. Like, it would be, like, mean the most to me. But when I was, like, 10 and I had to do that, that was like the worst fucking day ever. Like, I would hate, I'd be so bored all day, like trying to figure out things to do. And like, so like, I have to remind myself, like, as much as you want to go back there, it wasn't all the greatest thing in the world. Like, there was a lot of like mundane, boring shit that went on too.
Mm-hmm. I think people forget too, like, we only had the 3 or 4 channels, right? ABC, NBC, right? Like, CBS. Yeah. So like, your options were really limited. So when you talk about, like, we all watch, like, He-Man and then, like,
yeah, G.I. you really Joe. Did. Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, you'd watch, like, because there was very, very little on, and very little in terms of children's programming. So, like, you'd watch a lot of, I remember watching game shows all the time because, mm-hmm. like, they were on during the day. And then, like, 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I had to give the TV up to my grandma so she could watch, like, Bold and the Beautiful or like some kind of like yeah. soap opera.
Even as a kid, like, I'd watch like MASH and Three's Company. I didn't necessarily get all those yeah. jokes, right?
You know, like, yeah, yeah. I remember watching Three's Company all the time. Like, that was another thing they would replay old shows from the 70s like that, What's Happening, Different Strokes and all those shows too were on, like, after the cartoons, they started showing those shows too.
Throughout He-Man, there's a couple of, like, Simpsons Easter eggs.
Oh, yeah.
How do you think something of The Simpsons, which is still going after, like, 30-odd yeah. seasons, like, 35 seasons now, how do you think that's going to get viewed? Because we've never seen something last this long, right?
So I don't know. There's, like, multiple Simpsons generations, right?
Yeah, that's, like, weird.
Yeah, it is. It's strange. So, like, my generation... like, I couldn't imagine really getting interested in or caring about an episode that takes place, like, after season 10, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's, like, tons of kids out there or whatever, people that, like, didn't even start watching it until it was, like, season 15 or something like that, you know? Right. So they all have, like, a totally different idea of what the show is and nostalgia for different episodes I never even seen, or even characters I probably never heard of that have been on it at this point.
Would you want your kids to, like, start watching it if, like, when they got to, like, 10 years old or 12 years old, to, like, sit down and,
what,
like,
The Simpsons?
Yeah. That's because that's a definitely. Lot of homework.
I definitely, because, like, I'll watch it with them because it's so funny. And we watched The Simpsons Christmas special last night. Me and my whole family watched mm-hmm. it. My kids are, like, 2 and 6. But I, you know, so I have love for The Simpsons so much. I don't know why I kept throwing them in there as Easter eggs for some reason. I was just like, I'm going to keep adding The Simpsons in here. There's a lot of Simpsons references.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But that's why I find it kind of unique, because, like, all the other shows that we've talked about have, like, Star Wars did, like, 3 movies and then they went away for a little bit, right? Like,
yeah.
He-Man had some like dark periods and it went away for a little bit. G.I. Joe, like, stuff's always been floating around and it keeps coming back, but there are dark periods. And where Simpsons is one of the few that's like, the longevity's bitches have been impressive because it just keeps going.
Right, right. And you know, I think that if they ever did cancel it or something like that, it would get rebooted right away almost.
Yeah, like Futurama, right? Like it just
keeps going. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if we'll ever see an end to that show.
I think because it's an animation, I'm like, just keep going.
You know, yeah, like, why ever stop?
Yeah, even if it's just a million people are watching it or whatever, or like you said, like there will be generations who will keep discovering it as you keep putting it on Disney and allowing it to be like streamed and stuff like that. People will find it.
Definitely.
Yeah. Are you enjoying some of the new incarnations for like He-Man and things like that as they bring them back?
I liked the Thundercats reboot from 2012. That was like this kind of like you couldn't ask for a better reboot. I feel like they just like upped the ante of like the first, you know, series and like played a lot on like the mythology of the series. I thought that was really good. I know it like wasn't super popular or whatever. I don't know if you call this a reboot, but I watched it recently, Dragon Ball Super.
Yeah.
Which was really good. I really like the last saga a lot, the tournament.
We can wrap up now. The book is called The He-Man Effect, How American Toymakers Sold Your Childhood. Did you have a lot of fun? It seemed to me like you were like kind of cracking up, or I felt like you were enjoying yourself making this book.
I was part of it. I was like, this is just an excuse for me to draw toys and cartoons and stuff that I liked. compared to the work that I'm doing now, it was a lot of fun. As well, like even working on like the Putin book, like making comics is always fun to me, but like, you know, being able to work on, being able to draw all this stuff that I was like interested in looking at anyway, and getting the source material, like in the Sears catalogs and stuff like that, was like super fun.
What is the Putin book? Just give us a teaser or like,
oh, it's out. It's called, The Accidental Tsar. And it was written by this guy, Andrew Weiss, who is a Putin expert. And I illustrated it. And, you know, it was fun. It's obviously like different type of material than the He-Man book.
It's funny because like you do a lot of the like nonfiction graphic novels, and I think for some people that's still like new. They still think of comic books as like Batman, Superman,
you know, sure.
But like you've done one on like Tetris, you've done one on Andre the Giant, this one's on He-Man. What is it about like nonfiction or like kind of those biography types in terms of telling them in a graphic novel story setting that attracts you? What sparks your interest there?
I think it's just like stuff that I'm naturally interested in. And also I just find it to be like, you know, I study things on my own for like my own, like when I'm not even making books and stuff. So making these books like gives me an outlet for that. And it's just something I'm interested in. And I'm working on a fiction book right now and it's really, really hard. And so, I wish I was working on a nonfiction book right now.
Because with nonfiction, the plot's already done for you.
It's already there. Yeah, yeah.
Right? So I get it. So it's The He-Man Effect, How American Toymakers Sold Your Childhood. Thank you, Brian, for like hanging out. We covered all the big ones, right? Like,
yeah, yeah.
We even got Silverhawks in there.
Definitely. Yeah. All right, man.
Yo, that was Brian Box Brown, a cartoonist based in Philadelphia, talking about his graphic novel, The He-Man Effect, How American Toymakers Sold You Your Childhood. I'm Sammy, host of My Summer Lair. In My Pal Sammy, a weekly Substack newsletter, I write to place the past into a less messy context. As you've heard, Brian and I clearly had similar childhoods. Like, we played with the same toys and grew up watching many of the same compelling cartoons. We have He-Man in common. Yet as a nerd, I've often had issues with nostalgia. I'm not a fan of nostalgia, even though nostalgia is a vital part of the fan experience. It's annoying. The notion of a rosy past is so tempting. Yet when I choose to mind the past, it is because I recognize what we've lost. This is not an automatic knee-jerk reaction. The past was better. Or like that whole thing with Trump, right? Like, to make America great again. None of that. Rather, it's naturally understanding that with every advancement, it comes with a sense of loss. In music, we went from vinyl to cassettes to CDs to MP3s. Are MP3s easier to take your music with you? Absolutely. And I'm grateful for those advancements. But what have we lost in that sonic progress? Album covers, album artwork, and all those artists are just one obvious example. We lost a lot of that. Vinyl came back, even though it's a much harder technology. You can't carry that with you like the way you do with an MP3. Vinyl came back because of that loss. Every advancement should prompt mourning, because there are certain things that we will never be able to get back. That's the tension. You can't have progress without advancement, but what do we lose in that advancement? To understand what was lost and what we've gained is why I write My Pal Sammy. And that's why I also have these My Summer Lair conversations. Because at the time it was, truly it was, an incredible childhood. G.I. Joe and He-Man and Transformers, all kinds of swords and characters and laser guns and ruckus. Sweet, sweet, delicious ruckus. But as Brian has revealed, there was more going on than just ruckus. So I gotta talk about it in my newsletter. Let's talk about the old man behind the wizard, right? Go to mysummerlayer.com/subscribe to sign up for My Pal Sammy. Let's continue this conversation talking about the past. Go to mysummerlayer.com/subscribe. Thank you so much for listening to me in a Netflix world. He-Man, yo!